This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/bookreview.
Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.
When we get pleasure from something, it's rooted in our beliefs about what that thing really is, that thing's hidden essence.
This week, a conversation with Yale psychologist Paul Bloom on the origins and meaning of pleasure.
Food tastes differently depending on what it is you think you're eating. A face can be either sexually arousing or sexually repellent, depending on whose face you think it is.
Writer at large for The Times, Charles McGrath, talks about John Updike's archive. The paper's media columnist and culture reporter David Carr discusses a new addiction memoir.
Plenty of people have tried cocaine and they get a sense of sort of the lurid ambush of the drug and they walk away. And there's certain among us who try it and think, well, not only was that great, but it's like the only thing now.
And Jennifer Schussler has bestseller news. We're hearing much in these troubled times about feeling good, especially about the subject of happiness. There's an important new book that raises the stakes in this conversation. It's called How Pleasure Works, The New Science of Why We Like What We Like. It's by Paul Bloom, and it's reviewed for us this week by Robin Moran's Hennig, who says, Bloom has written a book that's different from the slew already out there on the general subject of happiness. No advice here. Bloom is after something deeper than the mere stuff of feeling good. I'm delighted that Paul Bloom's here to talk about it. Welcome, Paul.
Thanks for having me here.
All right. Start us off. What's the difference between happiness, as we're hearing about it all the time, and pleasure?
Well, happiness is a great topic, and there's a lot of interesting work done on it. But what I'm interested in my book is everyday pleasures, pleasures that you could experience fairly quickly, fairly frequently in everyday life, the pleasures of sex, of food, of art, of the imagination, of religious ritual, of a favorite object. And what I do is I take these pleasures and I explore what we like about them, what we like about artwork, what we like about drinking certain wines, what we like about certain people, what arouses us, what interests us, what gives us pleasure.
Listeners should know, you're a scientist, you're a professor at Yale. So when you look at this, it's from the perspective of a scientist. Is that right?
That's right. I'm a professor of psychology and cognitive science, and I draw upon work done in my own lab and also work done in the labs of my colleagues and people around the world. And a lot of this work is experimental, drawing upon research with children, with babies, with adults, with people across different cultures, all of it looking at the conditions under which we like something. It used to be thought pleasure was, to a large extent, simple. We like this sort of chemical composition in our food. This smell we like. This smell grosses us out. Sexual desire is prompted by certain aspects of a person's physical body, the symmetry of their face, their waist-hip ratio. And I want to argue that it's actually quite a bit more complicated and quite a bit more interesting, that these pleasures, even the pleasures that seem the simplest, like sex and food, are actually surprisingly deep. When we get pleasure from something, it's rooted in our beliefs about what that thing really is, that thing's hidden essence. So food tastes differently depending on what it is you think you're eating. Wine tastes different depending on where you think the bottle came from and how expensive it is. A face could be either sexually arousing or sexually repellent, depending on whose face you think it is. There's a lot of work suggesting that how attractive you find a face depends on how much you like the person, whether you believe it's a familiar person or a stranger. A face and a body can inspire sexual lust until you realize that you're looking at somebody you're related to, in which case the very idea of sexual contact could elicit disgust. The physical features can be the same, but the response can be profoundly different.
Now, Paul, you've said that much of the thesis in your book is based on experiments. Could you describe the kind of experiments you've done?
Well, I'll tell you one experiment that I've done with Bruce Hood, who's a psychologist in England. And we were interested in what children like about their sentimental attachment objects, objects like teddy bears and security blankets. And you might think that what they get out of them is how they look and how they smell and how they feel. But we believed, based on parental anecdote, that when they're attracted to these objects, it has to be that specific object. A duplicate won't do. So to test this, we created a duplicating machine, a machine that if you put in an object, lights flash and a buzzer goes off, and then there's a perfect duplicate of it next to it. And of course, this is a trick. Bruce is an amateur magician. We set this up to fool the kids, and they totally bought it.
How old were the kids?
These were 4 and 5 year olds, and we did some stuff with 3-year-olds as well. What we found was that when we duplicated everyday objects, they got a great kick out of it. And actually, they preferred to take home the duplicate because it was so cool. But when we duplicated their precious objects, they really wanted the original. And in fact, many of them got very upset at the idea of us even handling and duplicating this object that they love so much. As adults, many of us have some object that we wouldn't want duplicated. It might be your wedding ring. It might be your child's baby shoes. It might be an artwork that you love. You're not going to be very happy if I take your precious artwork by Picasso and Chagall and duplicate it and hand you the duplicate and say, you can't tell the difference. Who cares? Well, you do care. People want the original.
And where is all this activity occurring in the brain? I mean, have you gotten to the level where you actually can measure responses? I mean, you use electrodes? Or how do you actually make an experiment like this work?
Well, the typical experiment doesn't use neuroscientific methods directly. We ask people questions. We see what their preferences are. We see how much they wish to pay. A lot of it connects more with behavioral economics than cognitive neuroscience. But there are some studies that do use neuroscientific methods. So my favorite study along these lines had people lying down inside an fMRI scanner. And while their brains were being scanned, they had wine delivered to them via a tube. And while they were sipping wine, they saw in front of them a screen that gave them information about the wine, including how much it cost. It turns out that they could be sipping the very same wine. But if they believe that it's expensive wine, the pleasure center of their brain lights up. It's not merely they think, this is expensive, I better tell people I like it, or I better act impressed. Rather, it's that this is expensive, I like it more, it's better wine. And so the experience is actually transformed.
You know, you remind me of something that has actually bothered me for a long time, which is I've noticed, not that it's happened often, but if on occasions where I've given tickets, free tickets to someone else to see a show or a film or a ball game, they always seem to complain about it. When I would expect them to be grateful for whatever they saw. And I wonder if in some way the event is cheapened for them for that reason, that they got it free.
One of the explanation therapists give for charging so much is that they claim that if they gave away their treatments for less, people wouldn't value them so much. And so it means more, and it has more of an effect if you charge them. Now, that's kind of self-interested, but I think in general there's a real insight there, which is that if you pay for something, it transforms the experience. Something you paid $500 for feels different than something you paid $10 for that you got for free.
Well, you won't have any experience of this because you're writing for us nowadays when we don't have any money at the book review. But there was a time when we could occasionally pay a little more. And I found with my colleagues and myself that if we had paid a well-known author somewhat higher fee for his or her review, we always seem to be more invested in the result, even if it wasn't any better. And that's the same principle, I guess.
It is. And the flip side is when you start paying money for it, it transforms the experience. And sometimes it transforms the experience in bad ways. So a classic social psychology experiment found that if people volunteer for something, they're more invested in it than if they get paid for it. And this is in large part because they reason to themselves, I'm volunteering for this. I must really want to do this. I must really support this political candidate.
What kind of reaction are you getting to this book among not just reviewers like ours who are fascinated and praise it, but within the fellowship of scientists? I mean, are these arguments being well received?
There's a lot of excitement over extending this analysis to art. To a large extent, people in my field have ignored the pleasures we get from painting and statues and ignored the pleasures we get from fiction and stories, despite the fact that this is a major part of our life. And so one of the things I try to do in my book, and I hope I'm somewhat successful, is draw scientists' attention to these very, very critical phenomena. The most controversial part of my book, I think, from the standpoint of people in the field, is my claims about more animal pleasures, such as sex and food. I view myself as an evolutionary psychologist, and in that my work is highly constrained by considerations of the fact that our brains have evolved, our minds have evolved to a large extent to solve adaptive problems. So I'm part of this community of evolutionary psychologists, But at the same time, I think evolutionary psychologists often underestimate the complexity of sex and food. Often they tend to think of these as fairly simple adaptations. Our sexual desire is primed to find the ideal mate. Our food desires have evolved to find foods that are nutritious and give us sustenance. And so the claim in my book is that that's all true, but that's not the only thing. It's not even the most important thing. To a large extent, it turns out that our desires for sex and food, these desires we share with other animals, are uniquely tainted and influenced by our higher order beliefs about things, our beliefs about what's natural and what's unnatural, our beliefs about what's moral and immoral. And I think this makes the study of these basic desires a lot more complicated, but also maybe a lot more interesting.
Paul, well, now you've brought up art and literature, which is something we're very interested in here at the Book Review. What do we know about why we like it? What are we learning about that?
I devote two chapters to literature, and this is because I think there's two separate stories of what goes on. One story is that we enjoy literature because, to some extent, it's reality light. Literature impresses us because it gives us imaginary versions of real-life things that we enjoy. This is why pornography is a universal human taste, because pornography is an attempt to mimic sexual stimuli that in the real world would be arousing. So we're aroused by it if we see it for real. We're aroused by it if we read about it in a story. We're aroused by it if we see it on our laptop. The second part of the story, though, says that there's some parts of literature that are uniquely pleasurable, that are pleasurable just because they aren't real. And this is how I address the fascinating puzzles, I think, of why we like horror movies and why we like tragedies and why we like things that if we saw them in the real world, we wouldn't like. And I think this is because knowing that they're fictional, knowing that they're not real, allows us to throw a mental switch and treat them as a form of play, as a form of imaginary practice where we can explore different possibilities and take pleasure in exploring these possibilities, but at the same time know that we are not in danger. The people we love are not in danger. Real people are not being harmed. And so literature has two powers. One power is to mimic the real world, and we like that. And a second power is to establish something that we know isn't real, and in that way exercise certain capacities that just don't get exercised in any other way.
Thanks a lot, Paul.
Thank you.
That's Paul Bloom, whose new book, How Pleasure Works, The New Science of Why We Like What We Like, is reviewed in this week's Book Review.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. For listeners of this podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. One book to consider is The Other Wes Moore, One Name, Two Fates by Wes Moore. It's a haunting true story of two men with similar backgrounds but very different futures. Publishers Weekly describes it as a moving exploration of roads not taken. That's The Other Wes Moore, One Name, Two Fates by Wes Moore. Available from Audible. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/bookreview. That's audiblepodcast.com/bookreview.
For some of us, every week is the week of John Updike, but this week particularly so, his archive became available, and I happened to get a look at it. And Chip McGrath, my great colleague here, Charles McGrath, writer at large of the New York Times, has also looked at some of the material, and we're going to talk about it. Welcome, Chip.
Hi.
Well, it's no surprise that Updike was a great writer and that he was a prodigy who wrote brilliant prose when he was a teenager, but no one knew how carefully he was preparing his legacy. Any surprises for you in this?
I guess I'm not surprised. I kind of sensed it. You would have sensed it from the care that he took every decade or so, bringing out one of these huge omnium gatherums of his collected prose. And it collected everything, you know, little if he gave a paragraph to a magazine about his favorite hour of the day, which he did once, it would be collected there. You had a sense that this was someone who took his own Irv very seriously and collected it all. And so that he would have this other archive didn't exactly surprise me. What surprised me, though, was the depth of it. And when you mentioned that he would even in the box for for rabbit rest have the planter's peanut packet. I mean, this to me, that was what was eye-opening. And the other eye-opening thing to me was how good and how interesting the stuff, these letters that he's writing home from Harvard at 19 are. I mean, they're remarkable. Most writers, most great writers at that age don't know who they are. And he kind of did.
That's the surprise, yes, because we're speaking of this remarkable letter he wrote to his parents in which he essentially sketches out his literary mission, which is to write what he calls an epic out of the Protestant ethic, also what he thought American literature needed. And yet, Chip, we've discussed this. We discussed it online. It's not as if Updike had read and mastered the entire modernist canon at that point that he's quite dismissive of.
No, not only that. I mean, one has the sense that though he read a lot of his teenage reading was Agatha Christie and James Thurber and kind of pop magazine stuff. I think he was not particularly well read, actually, in the modernist canon, or maybe even in the American canon. And yet, that's what's so remarkable. He understood exactly where his place would be.
And yet, Chip, you've also said, because you knew Updike very well over the course of many years and in many different contexts, playing golf with him, editing, just being a friend, he was, is it possible to say, the most modest and unassuming of the great contemporary writers just in person?
Absolutely. The most modest and unassuming writer I have ever met, period. And yet, he one sensed even when he was being modest, sometimes there was a bit of a twinkle about it, you sensed that he knew how good he was. How could he not? But no one ever was less self-important in public.
How'd he do it? How does somebody that good manage to maintain that? Was that part of the equipment that enabled him to retreat into himself?
I think it was. To say it was a pose is to go too far, but it was who he was, and it enabled him. I mean, he did not – deliberately did not really take part in a lot of the scrum of American literary affairs. He didn't live in New York. He didn't go to book parties. He didn't have an agent. He wasn't competitive on the money end of things. He lived in small town Massachusetts, and he lived the life of a suburbanite, and then when he became a little better off, the life of a sort of North Shore waspy squire. He didn't hang around with literary people. He just worked all the time.
Yeah.
And he treated it in a way as a kind of a job, as a vocation. And I think not getting too grand about it was part of his secret.
Thanks a lot, Chip. That's Charles McGrath, writer at large at the New York Times. In the continuing outpouring of addiction memoirs, we've got a new one. It's called Portrait of an Addict as a Young Man, a memoir. It's by Bill Clegg, and it's reviewed for us this week by someone who knows something about the subject, the great David Carr, who's here to talk about it. Hey, David.
How are you?
All right. So does Clegg have a story to tell?
We all do, don't we? I mean, I was listening to a guy from Gaslight Anthem talk about their new record, and the prissy NPR person said, "Will you write about this guy? He's got like tattoos on his knuckles. He's a hard luck guy. He never gets what he's wanting." She says, "Who is this guy?" And he answered, "Who isn't this guy?"
That's great.
And that's part of what I think people all secretly feel, that maybe they've got some little monster creeping around in them.
Well, to look at Clegg's photograph, he's kind of a clean-cut character. What's his story? He was a literary agent, right? And still is, pretty successful in Manhattan. Got into drugs.
Yeah, I don't know what a crackhead looks like. I've seen one in the mirror before, but they come in all sizes and shapes. I think that Mr. Clegg's memoir is distinguished, number one, from the height he fell, which was significant. He made a very big splash in the New York literary community. And the sort of velocity of his fall, tens of thousands of dollars, many, many sort of fancy hotels downtown. There's this diaspora from fancy hotel to fancy hotel, and he more or less goes in, sets up shop, and turns these really tony little boys into crack houses.
And how did it happen? Was he a guy who always had addictive qualities, or did he just walk in the wild side, or are they the same thing?
The question of why in addiction memoirs is always tough to, you know, I had my own go around with crack cocaine, and I did a whole book about it, and I never really figured out exactly why. There's some hole somewhere that needs to be filled, and some people have larger holes than others. And I think a lot of people, plenty of people have tried cocaine, and they get a sense of sort of the lurid ambush of the drug, or they see how they feel the next day or what their bank account looks like, and they walk away. And there's certain among us, Mr. Clegg, me, others, who try it and think, well, not only was that great, but it's like the only thing now.
And he was quite successful literary agent, number of major authors, apparently had some talent. For those who don't understand what that might mean, he could actually spot a good coming young writer. He could see, you know, where a promising voice might be coming from. But he was not really a kind of insider, cool, born to the Manhattan lifestyle, right? That's part of a story, too.
That's very apparent in his book that, you know, in recovery, people talk about feeling like frauds. And he was a guy who was significantly unconnected, who really didn't know much of anybody here. And through, by dint of his ambition, skill, luck, was able to clout a fairly significant role here. And as you say, had a pretty good gimlet eye for talent on the rise. And I understand that many of those authors have since come back to him, which is a testament to the fact that he must be good at his job, because during his active addiction, he pretty systematically screwed all of them. You know, didn't make meetings, didn't live up to commitments, failed to get on airplanes. There's a lot of, you know, watching the wheels pop off in this book, it's an incredibly lurid, dark book.
David, he still looks like a very young guy. I mean, how old was he when this was happening? In his 20s?
I think late 20s into his 30s, and he experienced some success, dabbled in cocaine, and then tipped over into it. He had a wonderful apartment, a wonderful partner, and a great nascent business, and he pretty systematically tore the arms and legs off of all those things. One of the things that I found not particularly satisfying in his book, and it was a critique that people had of mine as well, you don't really get a sense of what happened to the people around him. There's a narcissism and a focus on the needs and desires of self that is fairly relentless in most addicts.
David, when you were first reading this book, we talked about it a little bit before you wrote the review, and you said it did make you reflect on your own memoir, Not of the Gun. How so?
Well, for one thing, when you lived through something and you know that you lived through it and you're safely out on the other side, it's a fairly straightforward matter to put those things on paper. But to somebody who just walks up to these things that happened, it can be incredibly horrifying. I, of all people, I'm about as far from judgmental as you can get. But I just watched the choices that he was making time after time and just said, really? You did that? I mean, I felt like a church lady reading this book. And here I am, a person who's been through, you know, a fairly similar experience. The corrosiveness of the addiction lifestyle. I mean, one of the problems with all these memoirs, including my own, is addiction at bottom is a chronic activity that you repeat over and over in the same way. It's about the getting and using of a substance. You know what? That TikTok gets pretty boring after a while.
David, do you develop a kind of radar as to the candor and integrity in a book like this? Can you see when he's faking it, when he's really delivering the goods? And does he deliver the goods for the most part?
When James Frey wrote his book, I read about 12 pages in, and I said, this guy's full of baloney, and threw it over my shoulder and had really no idea of what the implications of that were. That's some kind of reporter I am. That bell never went off with this book. I'd say every word of this book rings true to me. He's got a freakish ability to recall detail. I don't know how he did it, but I read it as authentic. I do think at the end quote sort of epiphany or white light moment, I think there's some fudging going on there. I think that he didn't land safely and then everything was okay. I think there were probably – that was a more organic series of stumbles that eventually resulted in some kind of professional and personal stability. But in terms of him – making a little worse or a little better in spots. I never got that feeling reading the book. I think this is a truthful storyteller. He tells it in such spare and direct ways that some people experience his style. I experienced it as not exactly a joy to read. There's a kind of archaeology or numerology to it where it's devoid or divorced from experience in a way where I didn't really feel like I was I wasn't experiencing the emotional content of what was underway.
Thanks a lot, David.
That's David Carr, who this week reviews Portrait of an Addict as a Young Man, a memoir by Bill Clegg. Jennifer Schuessler is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Sam.
What's new on the list this week?
Not a lot of news, and no news when it comes to the bestseller list is either good news or bad news, depending how you look at it. Stuff My Dad Says, Justin Halpern's book, is still on top of the nonfiction list. It's been on the list for 6 weeks now. Not bad for something that began as just a stream of Twitter posts. One new title on the nonfiction list, Anthony Bourdain, the rogue chef, is back with Medium Raw, his latest follow-up to Kitchen Confidential. Here he talks about the changes in the restaurant and food culture in the past 20 years and the people responsible for them.
And he's high up on the list, too, right?
He's at number two.
Whoa, what about the fiction list?
Stieg Larsson's still at number one with The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest. A couple of new books. Nelson DeMille's latest thriller, The Lion, enters at number two. And Justin Cronin's thriller, The Passage, the one about the vampires who have taken over America in the future, enters at number three.
What about Glenn Beck? His new thriller has been getting a lot of attention, no?
Yeah, he's gotten some savage reviews in the Washington Post, various liberal sites, and it's called The Overton Window, and it's not yet on the list. It came out just after the sales window for this week's list, but I have a strong feeling we're going to be seeing him next week and for a long time thereafter. It sounds like kind of a crazy book. There's apparently some subplot about a plot to nuke the office of the Senate Majority Leader, who coincidentally shares a Las Vegas address with Harry Reid, and lots of pillow talk about the flat tax, that kind of thing.
Well, Beck is very big on thrillers, right? He's been promoting them on his show for a long time.
Yeah, he's really, as we've talked about, emerged as a huge kingmaker in the publishing industry. And, you know, when it comes to your own book, it doesn't hurt that you've got your own TV show and your own radio show where you can really talk it up.
Well, in fact, he's had a great success promoting that great intellectual thriller, The Road to Serfdom by F.A. Hayek.
Earlier in June, he devoted an entire hour of his show, if you can believe it, to The Road to Serfdom. It's a kind of classic libertarian economic treatise published in 1944, a big bestseller in its own day. And the book sold about 60 to 70,000 copies in the week after Beck had the show, which was basically as much as it had sold in the past 5 or 6 years.
Wow, so he really may be the new Oprah.
That's true. You got to get him talking about your book, Sam.
Thanks a lot, Jenny.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening. Join us again next week on Inside the New York Times Book Review. Remember, there's more at our website, nytimes.com/books. For the New York Times, this is Sam Tannenhaus.